It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at Wisconsin's wolf hunt. It ended last week. We'll find out how it will affect the wolf population in Wisconsin and hear about some controversy surrounding the hunt.
First, though, a look at some of the best songs of 2013 with NPR's resident music guy and a frequent guest here on the Ideas Network.
Stephen Thompson is with us. He's an editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist for NPR's Song of the Day and Pop Culture Happy Hour podcasts. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
That's good to be back.
You gave us a nice list of songs, and we'll listen to most or all of them. But first, your overall sense of 2013, was it a good year for music?
I think it was, you know, and it's interesting. We've spent the last probably 6 weeks or so at NPR Music squabbling over over what our favorites were. And we have genre specialists in everything from pop and rock and jazz to hip hop and metal and you know, world music and classical music. And so, you know, we wind up squashing everything together into these, you know, into these incredibly diverse lists. And it forces everybody to discover a lot of different stuff. But of course, the stuff that I brought tends to be the stuff that I personally was advocating for. It was a very good year for music.
And most of your songs are not things that hit the top 40 levels on the pop scene, but were there some high and low points in the year in pop music for you before we get to your selections?
Well, I mean, you know, there are always a certain amount of, there are always songs that are incredibly ubiquitous. I think it was a different year from last year. If you remember last year, it seemed like for a big chunk of the year, I'm talking about 2012 here, that there were three songs. You know, there was Call Me Maybe, there was Fun's We Are Young, and
the Gaudier, right?
Yes, Gaudier, somebody that I used to know. Thank you. Very good. And this year, you know, I felt like we jumped around a little bit more. You had your Imagine Dragons and your Miley Cyrus and, you know, and everything like that. But everything felt a little bit spread out a little bit more. It didn't feel as much like everything coalesced around like two or three songs.
Well, you've given us not two or three, but 10 songs. Let's see how many of them we can go through this hour. Let's start, and we'll give a listen first and then talk about this one. Carrie Musgraves, and the song is...
Casey Musgraves.
I'm sorry, and here's why I did it. The song is Merry-Go-Round. I took the airy and put it on Casey.
Yep.
Casey Musgraves.
Two kids by 21, you're probably gonna die alone. At least that's what tradition told you. And it don't matter if you don't believe. Come Sunday morning, you best be there in the front row like you're supposed to. Same hurt in every heart.
I was just about to talk, but I remembered I really liked that chord progression when I pulled that song earlier, and I didn't want to talk over it. It's very surprising for a country-ish song to have that weird drop like that. Talk a little bit about Casey Musgraves and Merry-Go-Round.
Well, it was among other things, to me, a remarkable year for country music, and particularly women in country music. And Casey Musgraves is a 25-year-old singer-songwriter who made my favorite album of the year. It's called Same Trailer, Different Park, and I found it an incredibly emotionally affecting record, as you know, you kind of get a little bit of a glimmer of that in that song, which is about the you know, some of the more mundane downside of living your life in a small town if you're somebody who isn't suited to it. And it's you know, there are a bunch, it's coming, that record is coming from a bunch of different points of view, and you know, I just think it's full of these beautiful, beautiful songs.
And this was a surprise to me. A country song, usually, stereotypically in country music, it's going to celebrate life in
right.
a small town. This song, I mean, we only heard a little bit of the lyrics. It goes on. It is not a happy scene.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the fact of the matter is, there's nothing wrong. You know, I grew up in a small town, actually, in Wisconsin, Iola, and I love Iola, but you know, it's not necessarily something to be entirely always glorified. Like living anywhere, it has its upside and its downside, and it's not suited for everybody. And so, this record spends a lot of time poking around in gray areas that in a way that I found immensely appealing, and just the songcraft is beautiful.
I don't know if you've seen this. There was a video going around where somebody had taken clips from a handful of country music songs and, you know, got the line about the truck and the line about the girl and the line about the town. And really, I mean, it I don't know how accurate it is. It created a stereotype of pop country music as just really one-dimensional. Is that fair?
There's a classic David Allan Coe song,
oh, yeah.
You Never Even Call Me By My Name, and it has this verse in it late that he, you know, because he wants to include everything that he had been told to put in his songs as a country singer, and it's, you know, like, I was drunk the night my mama got out of prison, and I went to pick her up in the rain, but before I got there in my pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train. And so it's just, because it had to include trains, pickup trucks, mama, you know, being drunk, you know, and
death,
so he tried to shoehorn as many cliches as he could into this one verse.
All right, let's move on to our next selection now. This is Nico Case, and the song is Man. Bring that down and overlook my editing error there where I didn't clip out the bit where my meeting notification popped up. I really thought I caught that. That's what happens when you don't have the producers do it. Anyway, Nico Case is a name I am more familiar with than most on your list. Talk a little about the artist and the song and the new album.
Well, she's just an incredibly smart singer-songwriter who put out another one of my favorite albums of the year. It's called The Worst Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. So the album title is that long, and then my favorite song on it is called Man. But it's just this fantastically snappy, this particular song is just this fantastically snappy, fun, hard-driving, just terrific little three-minute rock song, but also about you know, gender politics and gender identity. And, you know, obviously she's singing from the perspective of what she sees as a man's man. And so it's got these neat little twists to it and a couple of real kicker lines, which I cannot say on the radio, late in the song. So it's just this terrific little, you know, top down, windows down rock and roll anthem, but it's also smart.
So a big jump there from country to a rocking along little anthem. Is it hard for the music industry to predict what people are going to want to listen to and to get their micro marketing down right these days?
You know, it's incredibly tricky. I think, you know, the music industry is in a very, very strange and difficult place right now because obviously of piracy and downloading and just adapting to the new and different ways that people are listening to music. And I think that one of the side effects of that and of the way that everybody is, you know, that all these niches are being served simultaneously, it becomes harder to come up with a song, you know, like a really big song. You know, we mentioned before the Gotye song and the Fun song and the Carly Rae Jepsen song that were omnipresent last year. It's, when you think about it, that's an incredibly rare thing to pull off in this day and age because we don't all just have one place that we turn to get into music. There are hundreds and hundreds of different ways, you know, TV commercials and Spotify and you know, and iTunes and, you know, there's so many serendipitous ways to come across music, but they're not necessarily ways that every single person in the world comes by simultaneously. So you get, I think, a lot more, you know, you could reach, you know, a million people at 1 inch deep, or you can reach 10,000 people a mile deep. And those are two different, for lack of a better term, business models as ways to succeed in the music industry. But they're obviously very, very different.
Is this good or bad? I mean, it's good that we can all go off and seek our own thing, but maybe it's bad that we don't have that common musical language anymore.
I think it is. I think I mean, I think like anything, it's a mixed blessing. I think that there are a lot of people who historically have defined themselves in opposition to mass culture. And I think that's harder and harder and more pointless to do, you know, because let's say you're a fan, I mean, to go into television and movies. Do you know the TV show Veronica Mars?
Oh, yeah.
It was like it was a low-rated but very intensely beloved TV show. And nowadays, you know, the gatekeeper that would keep you from getting that show, you know, the mastermind behind Veronica Mars set up a Kickstarter campaign to raise a couple $1 million to make a Veronica Mars movie. And it's not for a mass audience. It is for this intense cult that has coalesced around the TV show Veronica Mars. And I think that you know, that's where a lot of music fandom and fandom in general is going, is super serving intense fans. So you have, you know, I don't know that there are necessarily intense Carly Rae Jepsen fans who are like, are you know, in a cult of Call Me Maybe, you know, but there might be, you know, but an artist like Amanda Palmer, who is much more of a very specific kind of music serving a very specific you know, subset of fans, she can raise $1 million to make her record and be a very successful artist, super serving 25,000 people.
More songs coming up with NPR music reviewer Stephen Thompson. We're talking about his picks for the best songs of 2013.
And you can join in, too. Do you have a favorite, or maybe a least favorite, song of the year for 2013? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you can't live without or what you're trying to avoid this year, or you can tweet us at Central Time, WPR.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We pick up our conversation now with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music. We're talking about the best songs of 2013.
And let's get right back to Stephen's list, his selections for best songs. Josh Ritter will give a listen. The song is Joy to You, Baby.
I go to the parties, throw my hands in the air. I drink what they pour me, cups of who cares. Go up in the night sky, up in the clouds.
So Stephen, a little folkier selection than the one so far.
Yeah, and that song is building to something that I found really interesting and striking. It's from a record called The Beast in Its Tracks, which is entirely it's sort of a concept album about Josh Ritter's own divorce. And, you know, there are a lot of great breakup records. Breakup records are
a staple.
Are a staple and a standard. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of them have entered, you know, the canon from your Blood on the Tracks to your Bon Iver, you know. But this particular record, I was especially struck by how much I love the song that we just played. And, you know, we didn't get to the chorus of it. But, like, ultimately, it's you have in so many of these breakup records, they're chronicling a lot of bitterness and they're chronicling a lot of negativity and sort of how, you know, the person is processing this very raw sensation. And what I love about this song is that the record is going through this entire process, and this song gets all the way to acceptance. And so it's this very heartfelt and warm and mature and very compassionate and empathetic song where he's wishing his ex-lover well, and also, and you know, in the process of being generous to her, is being very generous to himself. I really love that song.
So it isn't just, it's all your fault and I'm better off
right.
without you.
Right. It's not just pain. Wah. You know, so because ultimately that's what you want in that process of getting over a breakup, is you want to come to a point where you actually want everybody involved to be happy.
All right, another artist, help me with the pronunciation here. Rye?
Yes, Rye.
Rye.
R-H-Y-E. Yeah.
Yeah. So Rye the Fall. Here's a sample.
Love to me.
So very haunting vocals there.
I haven't heard that version of it. That's a different. That's not the version that's on the studio album. That's clearly like a studio session somewhere. But it's
gorgeous. This is a live one I pulled. I should have said that. Yeah.
Yeah. No worries. It's very, very beautiful. The version on the album moves a little bit more quickly, but has that same languid, that beautiful piano line, that high, warm, androgynous vocal. Rye's a really interesting group. It's a duo, and you never see their pictures. So all of their press materials or their press photos in, you know, the videos never show anybody in the band. And when the band first came out, nobody knew anything about who they were. And there were a lot of people actually who thought the singer, whose name is Mike Milosz, who thought he was a woman. You know, these kind of Sade style love ballads. And the whole record is called Woman. And that song is The Fall. I've said this before about this record, but you know, there are love songs and then there are these kind of seduction songs, but these are really songs about affection and intimacy. And so it is definitely this kind of sexy, bedroomy kind of record, but it's built around a real relationship and really a long-term relationship and how love and warmth and affection fit into that.
Steven, it seems like you're picking songs for grown-ups. What's going on here?
You know, I feel like, you know, everybody should get something out of music. And yeah, there should be more music for grown-ups, absolutely.
Let's go to another one on your list, Valerie June, Somebody to Love.
Well, if you're tired and feeling so lonely, you wake up at night thinking that only if you had somebody, will I be somebody? You're somebody to love.
Again, it sounds a little country-ish, but it kind of grows and develops from where it starts, doesn't it?
Yeah, she does not land on any one genre in a way I find very striking. She's a very, she's singular. You know, she doesn't sound like anybody else to me, even though obviously there are traces of singers going back 80 years in her music. So it's part folk music, it's part country music, it's part blues music. She grew up in rural Tennessee and is synthesizing a lot of very traditional sounds of the rural South. But to me, it still sounds contemporary.
Yeah, I want to get a couple more samples of a couple of the other ones. Bill Callahan now, Small Plane is the track by Bill Callahan, Small Plane.
Used to take me up. I watched and learned how to fly. No navigation system.
And another great voice there. You've got some great vocalists that I wasn't familiar with on your list, Stephen.
Yeah, Bill Callahan is wonderful. It's interesting, as I listen to these songs back to back to back, I'm like, wow, I really like songs that make me feel comfortable. I really like songs that kind of slow the blood and calm me down. That is such a wonderful song. Bill Callahan, he used to record under the name Smog, for those who know those records. And this particular record he made, it's called Dream River, and his stated goal for the record was for it to be, and I quote, the perfect end to someone's day. And I just love that, you know, that it's this very, it's his songs are about trying to find peace amid chaos, and oh, that song is just this instant calm. It just has this calming effect.
I'm not going to call for any more to play now, except right at the end. But just briefly, you picked one, a Deaf Haven Dream House, which is the opposite of what you just said.
Yeah, I loved. Yeah, it's Deaf Heaven.
Deaf Heaven, yes.
Yeah, that was a That I found out about through our metal guy. and you know, it, and definitely the vocals on Deaf Heaven, which we're not necessarily playing, it have that kind of, how did I describe it? Like an animal being torn apart by a hawk or something
kind of
like
shrieky,
that.
Yeah.
Shrieky, yeah. But at the same time, there's the song that I picked called Dreamhouse is 10 minutes long. And it has these booming swells and kind of this, they're like these little subtle, like they're guitars that sound like U2. And a real poppy undercurrent to this very intense, lurching music. And I love the way that it combines these kind of screeching, horrific vocals fit into a sound that is still very majestic and beautiful.
Well, Stephen, that's all the time we have. Thank you, as always, for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And I'll bring up here in the background, Laura, or rather Cynthia will, I won't take credit. Laura Mavula, Like the Morning Dew, another one on Stephen's list. That was Stephen Thompson. He's editor and reviewer for NPR Music, panelist for NPR's Song of the Day and Pop Culture Happy Hour podcasts.
Coming up, a look at Wisconsin's wolf hunt and what it means for the wolf population in the state. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're going out with Laura Mavula here on the Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Nothing less but memories.
The wolf hunting and trapping season ended last week in Wisconsin, but some controversies are expected to continue into the new year, including a higher quota for the wolf harvest and the use of dogs as part of the wolf harvest. WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach has been covering the wolf hunt. He joins us now. Chuck, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with the numbers. The quota for the wolf hunt this season was 251. That was more than double last year's number, as I understand it. Where did this bigger target, this larger quota, come from?
Well, there was a desire by the state and others to increase the quota because the last year's kill total, the 2012 kill total, was about 117. Not enough to make much of a dent, or if all of a dent, in the state's estimated wolf population, which is 800 or so, 825. It's an estimate, of course. So the decision was made to boost the quota and raise it. And this year, the Native American tribes in the ceded territories chose not to sort of lay claim to any. They didn't shoot any last year, but they this year just sort of decided not to even lay claim to any, and so the increase in the quota went up quite a bit.
Now, as I recall, the quota for this year, as I mentioned, was 251, and it seems as though at least the first part of that wolf hunt, those quotas around the state, there were different zones, and the quotas were being met relatively quickly.
Well, it's true, and there are six zones for the wolf hunting season and that started October 15th, and in five of those, things did proceed quite quickly, although some of us were looking closely at the numbers and noticed that Zone 3, this area stretching from Burnett County, sort of winding east over towards the Wisconsin River, in other words, Grantsburg over to near Merrill, was falling quite behind pace, if you will, well short of what the quota was. And the DNR said that while they had quadrupled the quota in that zone because it's an area sort of at the edge between farms and forest, and they wanted, and there'd been a lot of animal depredation, livestock killing by wolves in that area, and they wanted to make sure there was a higher quota for the wolves there. And, you know, gun and trappers took some, but not enough to prevent the use of dogs in the hunt, which started back on December 2nd.
And as soon as you mentioned dogs, that was a very big controversy this year, the first time legal use of dogs in the wolf hunt. Can you give us a little bit of background on how the dogs wound up being included in the hunting regulations and maybe present both sides of the argument?
Well, of course, it was proposed first and it was included in the law that passed in 2012. Various groups objected to the use of dogs and succeeded in keeping dogs out of the first wolf hunt, plus the quota, the lower quota, was reached pretty early on in 2012. So between the courts and what happened in the fields and forests, if you will, dogs were not used in 2012, even though, you know, it was proposed by various folks, including trappers, hunters, bear hunters that wanted to make use of their dogs in the wolf hunt. Didn't happen in 2012. This year it did, just in Zone 3, as we say, and was fiercely opposed still because the lawsuit that helped block the use of dogs in 2012 is still active. It's now basically the use of dogs was okayed early this year, but then it got appealed to the state appeals court and sitting in the appeals court waiting for some final decision on it. But since there was no final decision, the use of dogs was allowed to go ahead after the gun deer season ended, in other words, about December 2nd.
Now, as part of that controversy, we heard lots of fears that dogs and wolves would wind up, you know, fighting as part of all this, then there'd be all sorts of blood, and it would just not be something that that proponents of the opponents, I should say, of dogs being used wanted to see. Did we have any reports that there were any issues like that that occurred?
Well, there were various reports, mainly from animal protection and education groups, suggesting that pictures being posted on social media by some of the hunters showed wolves very bloody, not just maybe from gunshot wounds, but from dogs getting at them. But so far, I don't know of any reports of the DNR really ticketing anyone, any wardens ticketing anyone for violating the... Right now, dogs are only supposed to track and chase wolves, not engage with them, not fight with them, not having them chew on each other, if you will. That's supposedly illegal. Right now, we don't have any documented cases, according to the DNR, of the illegal behavior going on. But there's this thing where the hunters that used dogs don't have to bring in the wolf carcasses until the 5th of the month after all this happened, in other words, January 5th. So there's been a lot of wolf carcasses that haven't been examined yet, and there's going to be a question of who's going to examine them, how closely they will be examined. Will they be examined just for biological information about the wolves, or will they be looked at in a way to see if there was any lawbreaking going on?
Now, as we look ahead to next year, assuming that the wolf hunt goes ahead, taking a look at this year into account and all of those sorts of things, are there some changes that may occur in terms of either the quota or the methods used in the wolf hunt?
Well, a lot depends on what happens with upcoming population estimates, wolves having pups and so on in the late winter and into the spring, and how well the pups survive and how many survive. If the overall population estimate remains around 800, then there will be pressure to keep that 250 or so as the quota if the population has dropped off dramatically. And there are other factors, of course, like winter, a harsh winter, a roadkill, and other things like that that factor in. The debate will be whether to stay at 250, cut it back, increase it. The DNR has said it's flexible, but right now it's a little too early to say exactly what's going to happen. And then there's this issue of the court looking at the use of dogs, whether the dog use will remain part of the wolf hunt.
But for sure, it sounds as though it's a story that we'll be hearing more about.
Oh, yeah, and we've, there's some debate as to, uncertainty as to whether the DNR will update its wolf management plan. That's sort of been the framework for all this, whether that will be done by next year, or there's been some reports at one of the wolf advisory committees that things might not be done until early 2015, and there wouldn't be a new management plan until 2015, meaning the 2014 hunt, wolf hunt, could look a lot like it did this year, again with the dog being the wild card issue.
All right, Chuck, well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Quirenbach. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Since it's the end of the year, we're taking a look back, and now we're looking at the best the internet had to offer in 2013 in the form of memes.
Dictionary.com defines a meme as a cultural item in the form of an image, a video, or a phrase that is spread via the internet and often altered in a creative or humorous way.
We have an expert here to give us some of the top viral trends of the year. He is Brad Kim, editor of Know Your Meme. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be on the phone. Thank you.
So I've seen the numbers. The top meme of 2013 was, and we'll talk about the pronunciation of this, Doge or Doge. Well, first of all, what is that meme?
Okay, so Doge or Doge, it's basically a misspelling of a dog with a soft G or a hard G. Basically, it's a series of photographs of a Shiba Inu dog. It's a Japanese breed of a dog with the pointy ears and orange fur.
And he's a fluffy fella.
Yes, the puffy one. And it's pictures of Shiba Inu doing various things. The key feature is that they're captioned with a very silly internal monologues from the perspective of the dog. And they're written in, usually in broken English, and written in Comic Sans font, which is kind of the go-to font for, sarcasm or, tongue-in-cheek kind of humor. And it's one of those things, they're much better shown than told, but, one of the most popular examples is this, animated GIF of a Shiba Inu dog, tapping on bongo drums, and the captions say, "Wow, such skill, much accomplishment," or, "very endurance, so proud." It's kind of a, grammatically awkward, exclamations. And, it's supposed to be, this character that's very adorable and dumb because, the character is so easily impressed by everything. And, he tries to use interesting words, but they're never quite right in the right tense or proper tense. So, it's one of those, silly memes that, won't take too long for anyone to get. And it's a chuckle-worthy meme, I would say.
And when I first heard about it, I thought it was kind of the answer to the LOL cats, the picture of the cat with the funny, "I can has cheeseburger" types of things.
Yes.
But it's a little different, too, that whole stream of consciousness thing it has going.
Right. It's a slightly different character than its lolcat counterpart. But yes, like you said, it's definitely an emerging trend of the so-called lolspeak, which has been traditionally a territory of cats for many years. But it is definitely that kind of humor catching up with dogs.
So.
The main difference is that, the biggest, most obvious one being, it really uses Comic Sans font to its maximum lol value, if you will.
So before we move on to other memes, Brad, I want to ask, and a lot of people probably who look at these things or hear about them and are thinking, what the heck? Where do these things emerge? Who comes up with them, and how do they come to the attention of the greater internet public?
Mm-hmm. So, with Doge, it's interesting because, the earliest known mention of, the word Doge in referring to a dog comes from a very, very old episode of this popular Web Flash animation series called Homestar Runner. And it comes from an episode that was released in 2005, where one of the main characters refers to his sidekick as a doge with an e at the end. And the meme, the character of the Shiba Inu as Doge, it actually blew up on the internet fairly recently on Tumblr after the name became associated with Shiba Inus. Which, alternatively referred to as Shiba. That's another nickname for the dog is Shiba. So the character itself originates from Tumblr.
Hmm. And what does it take, though? Why does one thing hit critical mass? And I assume there are zillions of other things that people are trying to create as memes that don't come to the public attention like that.
Right. I think, one of the factors, the key factors that, made Doge such a popular meme is that, like we were saying before, this sort of, you know, broken English grammar, like things that are said from the perspective of an animal. It has really, been a cat thing, predominantly cat thing. And I think what we're seeing is, people trying to kind of, take an existing trope or a theme and really just trying to expand it into other, other species and other realms. In a way, it's kind of an evolved iteration of an ongoing theme.
And it is a cute dog. I want to move on to another meme, though. A word this time that took off, kind of a made-up word or a compound sure. made-up word, cringeworthy, is one yeah. that had been around for a while, I gather, but took off. First of all, what is cringeworthy?
So cringeworthy is, it's actually a pretty, common English adjective that describes, any thing that evokes the feeling of embarrassment on the part of the observer. In the context of the internet, it would be something cringeworthy would be any sort of, social media, meaning, a status update, video, or a photo, that makes the viewer go, oh my God, I can't finish, this. I can't, keep watching this. It's kind of like a train wreck. But it's also worth mentioning that it's kind of an evolved form of fail humor, which has been, a pretty popular genre of internet humor for years. It's somebody does something wrong and, everyone laughs. But with cringeworthy, pictures and videos, just slightly different because it's hard to flat out laugh at these failures because usually they tend to hit a little bit too close to home. So, for example, when you see a picture of your friend, who's got a brand new tattoo of a, of a meaningful quote, let's say, and you immediately spot a spelling error in it. Now that's, something where you can't really flat out laugh at because, it's one of your best buddies, but it's still something, that's hard to look at.
Well, from a word to a video, I want to play a little sample here. The Harlem Shake videos that were going around. Here's the song. And so the visual here, when they started, people were just kind of sitting around. One person, I think, doing a wacky dance, everyone else sitting. And then when the beat kicked in there, everybody in the background would have a costume on and they'd be jumping around and dancing. And lots of people online were recreating this video. Where did it come from in the first place?
The dance meme itself, there's a two-part to it. The song in itself is this electronic dance track made by an artist named Bauer in 2012. But the dance video meme itself came from this popular YouTube blogger. His name is Filthy Frank. And he made this video with a couple of his friends, and they were all dressed in this, colorful latex suits. They started this dance video where, they're dancing in a very chaotic way, wearing something really goofy. And the viral instance is actually another one that, that came after by this group of teenagers. They were hanging at a friend's house and, like you said, it begins with one guy just kind of, shyly dancing while everyone else is just kind of chilling. And then, the bass drops and everyone goes nuts. And, it took off in early February. And this Harlem Shake is kind of unprecedented in terms of scale because according to YouTube's analysis, within the first 2 weeks, there were about 40,000 videos that were uploaded, and with totaling views of like almost 200 million views. So it really exploded onto the scene, and the timing was interesting because it also kind of came off the heels of Gangnam Style in the previous year, hitting the 1 billion views mark. So I think it was It was introduced as the next Gangnam Style meme with a lot more of a solid formula. You know, it has a very, very easy to, you know, replicate formula and a routine to it. So, you know, it actually had a lot of holding with web companies, you know, like companies like BuzzFeed. And, yeah, these it had a lot of support from, you know, people at work. And there were lots of office, you know, videos that are based around Harlem Shake. But, yeah, it was definitely one of the biggest dance memes to emerge on YouTube ever.
And people out there are making their own, which is a really interesting thing, getting creative. We just have a minute or so left, Brad. Is there a favorite meme of yours, either from this year or just emerging now, maybe, that you're keeping an eye on?
Sure. It's, I guess, you know, something that would that I think will be, you know, continue to grow into next year is live tweeting. And, you know, live tweeting is just something when, you know, when you're it could mean that, you know, you're tweeting about an event in real time, but, you know, specifically kind of it's, you know, overheard conversations that are tweeted in real time from a third-party observer. So I think one of the bigger ones recently, even though it actually turned out to be a hoax, was this ABC producer who was on a, you know, on a flight to LA on Thanksgiving Day, and, you know, he started tweeting about this lady that was, you know, on the same plane, you know, that was giving the you know, attendants a lot of trouble. And so this sort of kind of eavesdropping on, you know, interesting gossipy, you know, conversations and just tweeting to the world about it, you know, it has its appeal.
Okay, Brad, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. Yes.
That was Brad Kim, editor of Know Your Meme. We've got one of those doges up on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way.